Powered by volunteer community involvement, this is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
And I host the horror film podcast and radio show Bikini Drive-In on CKUW. I'm joined by Cinematheque's programming director, James Adsmundson.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to start off by acknowledging that Cinematheque resides on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, and the homeland of the Métis Nation, and we are privileged to be able to live, work, and play on this land.
Today we are speaking with David Gregory and Kayla Ginnis, the director and producers of the documentary Tales of the Uncanny, which is streaming on Cinematheque at Home until January 8th. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having us.
Yes. Yeah.
Guillermo del Toro made this observation: ever since humans gathered around a campfire and could talk, we've been telling stories about the dark and what lives inside it.
Are you ready to be scared?
Well, I love anthology horror films, and there were a lot of them.
Short form horror, it's just this enduring medium.
So many anthology films have a framing story where it is someone reading stories.
A celebration of a lot of different talents and a lot of different voices.
Which allowed the stories to be comedic sometimes or dark as hell.
Very weird.
Nightmare fuel.
20 minutes of sheer terror.
It's so difficult to say favorites.
I really like the Corman Poe stuff.
I mean, do I like Tales from the Crypt or what?
You were fishing with that makeup. That was a seminal image.
One of the first film posters I ever designed was Monster Club.
It was just monsters, it was gore, it was fun.
This isn't the bloody army.
This isn't the bloody army.
This is not the bloody army!
Might be good to actually do a poll. There's always a lot of debate about what's their favorite episode, what's their favorite film.
We interviewed over 60 different people.
I mean, I've seen lots of them.
The Amicus.
Black Sabbath.
Creep Show 2.
Yeah, that's a great one.
I just was like, ah.
You were always kind of cherry picking which segment you like best.
I just couldn't narrow it down to one.
The high point to me has always been A Dead of Night.
That little segment is one of the most terrifying films I've ever seen.
It's one of my absolute favorites.
It was really fantastic.
And even though I worked on Creepshow, it's my favorite.
I share that sensibility with a lot of horror fans.
Perfect.
There's something about that human desire to want to tell scary stories to each other.
I just wanted to say that for people that don't know, we have a Winnipeg connection to Kayla. She actually used to work at Cinematheque. And I've been trying to remember when that was.
It was August of 2007 when I came. And I think I left in like November of 2008. So it was like as soon as the first Give Me Some Truth project festival thing was over, which I think was November of 2008. I left right after that, so I was there for just over a year.
Okay.
Cool.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt you, Olivia, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm done. I'm getting to the questions.
Okay, well, maybe we could just start off by both of you telling us what you do at Severin, and Kayla, you maybe could just start by talking about, like how you got involved working there.
Okay, well, David should start, because Severin starts with him, so.
Sure.
Okay, well, I started Severin in 2006 with my partners Carl Deft and John Cregan. And since then, we've been restoring and releasing mainly horror movies, but weird and wonderful cult movies from around the world on Blu-ray and special editions, restoring them and doing special features and giving them the treatment that we think that they deserve. And also we've produced a few documentaries like Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau, and Blood and Flesh, The Real Life and Ghastly Death of Al Adamson. And we also produced an anthology movie called The Theatre Bazaar. So we like to produce things as well, of which Tales of the Uncanny is our latest documentary to be released.
Yeah, and so I started at Severin in 2017, just as an editor. So as like a part-time editor working on bonus features there. And I would say in the last year and a half or so, I started shifting a bit more into the producing side for the featurettes, arranging interviews, getting them shot, and working with other editors, you know, to put the special features together. So David and I are talking back and forth all the time and exchanging ideas and stuff. And so when he was going to release The Theatre Bazaar for the new Blu-ray, he wanted to do a documentary about anthology films, like the history of anthology horror films. And he had already started on this project before I became a part of it. And then I became part of it sort of partway through as we were sort of building up the roster of interviewees for it. Yeah.
Nice. Cool. And how did Tales of the Uncanny get started?
So it was just that. It was basically going to be an extra on Theatre Bazaar. Mm-hmm. And I shot an interview with David Del Valle, the horror historian, to talk about the history of anthology movies. And then we wanted to fill it out with more detail. So that's when I asked Kayla if she could help me out getting some more people to talk about it. So she got Mick Garris, Jovanka Vukovic, Amanda Reyes and Bruce Hallenbeck to talk about their areas of expertise. And then when the pandemic started, we still wanted to get a couple more people to make sure the full story was told. Mm-hmm. But of course, we had the problem that we wouldn't be able to actually get them into the studio to record, which would have looked really out of place with these other professionally shot interviews. Not long after that, we put together a list of people that we could potentially contact, and it just evolved into kind of this poll of asking people what their favorite anthology movie was and their favorite anthology segment. And then the list got bigger and bigger, and we communicated with each other over who else can we get, because, you know, one of the things that happens when you talk about anthology films is people have their favorites and they have their favorite segments, and so we decided to sort of make it into that. And it turned out that everybody had they covered the entire spectrum of the history of anthology horror films with the films that they liked and were passionate about. So that's kind of how it evolved into this much more widespread opinion documentary about mm-hmm. you know, what are the best ones.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Like, was there a point when you're like, we have too many people, or do you think like, or were you thinking like, okay, we need to get more, or like, were there people like during like your research when you're reaching out to folks that was there someone that you really wanted that you couldn't get?
I think we got most of the people we wanted to get. I mean, we made a wish list, which actually just kept on growing, basically. And then as Mike Capone started editing it, we realized that we should really try and get more. I mean, there are more people we can speak to about this. And it was so fun to discuss this subject with people because, like I say, people were very passionate about it. And they had very, clear ideas of what were their favorites or if not their favorites, ones that had made an impression on them. So, you know, they tended to talk about more than one when we interviewed them. And so that's kind of it kind of evolved from there. And basically, there was a point where I was like, let's get more people, let's get more opinions on this subject and see what we want until you know, it got to a point where like, okay, we've got to cut it off now. But after we'd done the final kind of countdown of best episodes at the end, we still got Roger Corman after that, because it seemed silly. We hadn't even asked Roger Corman before that. He hadn't been on our list, funnily enough. But as, you know, the oldest living person who has directed an anthology movie, that seemed like an oversight. So I contacted him. And within 24 hours, we were on the Zoom and discussing Tales of Terror.
And I think, like, I mean, in terms of, like, adding more people and whether or not to stop, it was never a matter of feeling like, okay, we've got everybody, because obviously we know so many horror enthusiasts that we could just keep going forever. I think it was really that we had been accepted for a festival. So we had to
we had to get it finished and out for Black Friday. That was kind of the thing. Yeah. We had to work backwards from our actual release date. And so we were working right until the end to you know, get people involved.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was
probably still be interviewing people now.
and probably will continue to do so, but not, you know, for the movie.
I was also wondering, like, maybe this is just like the question that I wanted to ask you that no one else is interested in, but I was a huge fan of the show, of the League of Gentlemen, and I was wondering like what your connection is with them, because I know like you were looking for a copy of the Christmas special for your Christmas book at some point. So like, was there that happened before that you had like reached out to them for something else, or?
Well, interestingly, like my association with League of Gentlemen was actually more with Jeremy Dyson, who is not in the anthology movie. He's in my folk horror movie, which is another movie that Severin is producing. But so I had spoken to Jeremy Dyson, who's one of the League of Gentlemen, because he, and yeah, he actually did make an anthology too. He made the film Ghost Stories. But I had spoken to him for my book, I think, looking for photographs originally, because we had the League of Gentlemen chapter in there. And then I ended up moderating a Q&A with him when Ghost Stories came out, and I knew him from that. And then also we have a mutual friend in Gary Sherman, and so we met again sort of through him. And so we kept intersecting, and then he was interviewed for my folk horror film. And I think that's the only reason I didn't think to reach out to him for this particular movie, because he's already in the other movie, and so we sort of focused on Mark Gatiss and Reese Shearsmith for this one. But I think that David was the one who actually reached out to them, so I don't.
Yeah, well, we'd interviewed them before for the Blood on Satan's Claw disc, actually years ago for the UK Blood on Satan's Claw disc, where we went to the set when they shot the League of Gentlemen movie. And we approached Mark Gatiss first, because he'd done, you know, the history of horror. And in his interview, he talked about how him and Reese Shearsmith would do impersonations of Patrick McGee. And so immediately after that, I said, we have to get Reese Shearsmith as well, because I want them both to do a McGee-off in the film, which they did. And so they both did their own impressions of Patrick McGee, which was fun.
That's one of the high points of the film, too.
Yeah, me too. Makes me giggle every time.
I would have to agree. That's what I
think. Yeah, funnily enough, I actually, in an earlier cut, I actually had, because when Kayla interviewed me, I had done a Patrick McGee from Asylum, where a line from Asylum. So I actually had myself in between the two of those, which I thought was very presumptuous that I could be in the McGee-off with these two League of Gentlemen. So obviously I took it out.
Yeah, what do you think is appealing about horror anthologies?
Well, personally, I mean, I have said this before, but I think the appeal for the audiences and the filmmakers themselves differ a bit. But I think for audiences, a big part of it is that they come from this older tradition of storytelling, of like, you know, sitting around the fire telling ghost stories and trying to like, each person tells their story and they're trying to kind of one up the other person, you know, which is a similar dynamic that you end up with in an anthology film when there's different directors and stuff. But also short horror fiction has always been really popular and really viable, and people still really engage a lot with short horror literature, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's so short format horror is something that is still really respected and beloved. And so I think the anthology format kind of just expands naturally on that kind of thing. And then for filmmakers, I think part of the appeal is that they can make a film with less overhead, with less time commitment for themselves and for their cast and crew, which makes it more possible that they can get it done. And they also get the added promotional backing of, kind of like when you have a whole bunch of people making a film together, all of these people become ambassadors for the film itself, you know? So then you have like, instead of you trying to hustle your film yourself, there's kind of a whole team of you doing it. And so as a filmmaker, I think there's, you know, a sense of community around it that's very rewarding as a filmmaker. So.
And I think a lot of people saw their first anthologies when they were quite young. So they were kind of entryway films into loving horror. So I think this is why we found that so many people had strong opinions on what their favorites were and what their favorite segments were, stuff that had, you know, kind of stayed with them since a young age. And so there is something very nostalgic about the form as well, which people keep going back to. But having produced an anthology film and directed a segment of the anthology film, what Kayla's saying is correct. It's basically you're all kind of in it together, and it's not like you're just going out and making a short. You're actually making something that's under an umbrella theme. This is for the multi-director ones, which have become more prevalent in recent years, mm-hmm. although they do go back to the 40s. You know, you're basically, you're not just making a short which might not get seen, you're actually making a feature with your contemporaries that can be sold as a feature film without committing, you know, the years and years of effort and heartache that goes into trying to get a feature off the ground.
Speaking of which, we have a question from the chat for David and Kayla. In Severin's capacity as a film restorer and distributor, is there a white whale horror anthology that you'd love to give the Severin treatment to it?
That's a good question. I mean, for a long time, for me, it was The Uncanny, but I managed to track down the rights to The Uncanny and put that out, because that's one that I'd always loved, and it had been completely neglected on home video in the US, but that one we did. So I'm trying to think, what else would it be? Kayla, any ideas?
I don't know. I feel like a lot of my favorites, like, I mean, I consider the white whale to be something that's very elusive, and you know, but I feel like a lot of my favorites are things that actually do exist on disc.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some foreign things, like I had mentioned in an interview recently about this German movie called Parapsycho, Spectrum of Their Angst, Spectrum of Fear. That's a three-part thing that's has a lot of European actors in it. That would be recognizable to people who watch Giallo films and stuff like that. And it's a very weird anthology horror film made by a guy who was primarily a painter. So he was not, you know, he started off in painting and did theater and stuff. So he came from a much more avant-garde background. And so that's a really interesting one, but I wouldn't necessarily call it a white whale because I don't know that it's, you know, impossible to get or anything.
The one that that Adrian talked about, the Argentinian one that we ended up putting out on our Black Friday release of Tales of the Uncanny, a bonus disc with a film called Master of Horror on it, which is a very obscure 60s anthology with two Edgar Allan Poe tales, dubbed versions of Argentinian stories. And apparently this is from a longer film which had a third story, and the third story was The Telltale Heart, which isn't in Master of Horror. It might be nice to try and track down that longer Argentinian original edit of Master of Horror. And another one that's older, from 1943, is Flesh and Fantasy, which is, I mean, I don't even know if it's strictly horror, but it's definitely an odd anthology movie which predates Dead of Night, and that's one that's sorely in need of restoring and a re-release. That hasn't been out for a long time. Oh, and the real white whale, though, is the original Dr. Terror's House of Horrors from the 40s, which is a lost movie and was basically a re-edit of White Zombie, The Golem, and two other stories. And that they shot a wraparound for it to put it all together. But that movie's been lost for a long time.
Yeah, so I don't know. I can't think of another one that I would call like an actual white whale.
Grim Prairie Tales is another one that's way overdue for a proper release.
Yeah, there's not even the director, I don't think, has a good copy of that movie.
He does not, no. And the owner of the film, I tried to go on a search for the owner of the film afterwards, and so far have not turned anything up.
Yes, Grim Prairie Tales, that one came up in my folk horror movie as well. So we're also like wishing that there was a nice copy of it.
Yeah. I was wondering, like, one thing I noticed when it seemed like just about everybody that's a bit younger in the documentaries, they're all talking about, there was one film that they saw at a like way too a young age. Like they rented the video store and they shouldn't have, or they saw on late night TV and they were like, you know, sneaking into the living room to watch it, and it terrified them and traumatized them. And I feel like everybody that loves horror has a very similar story. And I'm wondering if the both of you could talk about what that film was to you when you were young that you watched and you probably shouldn't have, and that you know, formulated the love of horror in your brain.
Do you want to go first, Kayla?
Sure. I mean, like, it doesn't have to be an anthology, though, right? It could just be any horror.
Yeah.
Anyway. Because mine was Horror Express. My first memory is watching Horror Express, which I didn't know it was Horror Express until years and years later when I rented it again at Movie Village in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And I was just renting everything. Back then, I would just go into video stores and just start renting all the horror movies alphabetically. So I rented Horror Express, and I just was like, oh my God, this is the movie of all my nightmares. Like, I've had nightmares about it all through my childhood of this. I think it's Alberto de Mendoza that plays this like Russian priest, you know, that gets possessed. And that character was so scary to me that he, like, all through my childhood nightmares lived in my closet. And I would have this nightmare over and over again every night with this guy in my closet. And I always called him the man with green eyes, because he had these glowing green eyes. And then when I rented the movie again, he had red eyes. And I was like, that's weird. Why do I remember his eyes being green? So I called my mom and I was like, hey, I finally figured out what that movie is that the man with green eyes is from, except his eyes are red. Why would his eyes be red? And my mom is like, oh, you watched it at Granny's house. She has a black and white TV. So I just made his eyes green in my imagination. But I saw tons of horror movies as a kid because my parents were into, I mean, they weren't horror fans in terms of what we would define as horror fans. They didn't collect things related to horror really or anything like that, but they liked horror movies. And so they were fine with me watching them. You know, but it would be weird things that would scare me versus things that wouldn't scare me. So I wouldn't be scared by a lot of typical things like a lot of adult, you know, horror movies meant for adults, but things like Watcher in the Woods, which is a Disney movie, scared the crap out of me, you know, as a kid. So obviously there were certain things in that movie that are kind of triggered to scare kids more, you know. But I don't know, David, what about you?
Well, film-wise, it was King Kong, the 1976 one, but I have some pretty early anthology memories too. And one of the first horror films I saw on television when my parents were in the other room and I was with my sisters, they were like, quick, turn the TV over to BBC Two. And we caught the end of Curse of the Werewolf, which was followed by From Beyond the Grave. And we watched From Beyond the Grave, and I remember just absolutely loving it. The David Warner story with the mirror and all the bodies buried under the floorboards, and it was fantastic. At the end of that story, my mum came in, and that one's a particularly grisly one for an Amicus anthology. My mum came in, sent me to bed. She's like, you can't be watching this. I don't know how old I was, like six or something. And I was screamed and cried, but my sisters were older than me, so they were able to continue watching it. And the next morning I came back, so what happened in the rest of the movie, you know? And they explained to me, well, that was the end of that segment, and a completely different story started, and it was completely confusing to me that I don't understand how can a movie be structured like that. I'm sure I didn't use those words, but anyway, not long after that, my dad took me and my sister to see the Monster Club at the cinema, and then it all became clear, and I absolutely loved the Monster Club, and of course they were both produced by Milton Subotsky, which again I didn't know at the time, but that format was something that I was in love with ever since.
You touched upon this earlier, but so the film covers a wide history of horror anthologies, and I think it's such a great resource. Why did it feel important to cover several different films and to have so many voices involved in the project?
Well,
to cover several different films?
Yeah. Why did it feel important to cover, such a vast range of films? And
okay.
Yeah.
David, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say, like, once you get into something like this, Kayla and I are quite similar in that we want to want it to be as thorough as possible. So, you know, we wanted to make sure that every title, particularly every title that was either one that people cited as an important example to them, or ones that historically were important, like, you know, the early silent ones, which weren't necessarily picked by anyone as their favorite, but obviously they were important in the history of anthology. We wanted them to be covered in some way. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some films that aren't mentioned in there at all, which is frustrating, but there's only so much, you know, you can do in this kind of format. And in the 80s ones, there were many, many that went straight to video, which we kind of show in a montage of titles because nobody talked about them specifically. Mm-hmm. But really, it was a case that we just like to be thorough in the documentaries that we do.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because it seems like once you open up the can of worms of inviting, you know, the 60 plus people to be interviewed in the film, first of all, I just want to give kudos to your editor because Kayla, I used to work as an editor, and I can imagine that he had or she had a lot of a lot of footage to go through. So, but when you open that can of worms, it becomes, and like you say, you want to be as thorough as possible. I'm wondering, did you feel it became intimidating, like just because you wanted to make sure that this was like the film about anthology horror? And like, did you worry about leaving anything out, or like? I guess I was also wondering, like, if there was any films that you like personally loved that nobody talked about, and they didn't really get any screen time in the film.
No, I think the ones that we personally loved were covered, right, Kayla?
Because one I thought of after that's one of my favorites that nobody mentioned and that I forgot to mention.
Well, there you go then. Which one was that?
Guess what it is. You're going to kick yourself.
What?
The Company of Wolves.
Is that an anthology movie?
Yes. It's totally an anthology film. But for whatever reason, like, I don't think of it as an anthology film, but it totally is. And I was like, wow. I didn't think of it till after because I'm doing the folk horror movie at the same time and I was doing Company of Wolves stuff. And I was like, hey, wait, this should have been in the Tales of the Uncanny. But no one brought it up. And
No one brought that up. And, one film that was brought up that we didn't put in was The Seven Faces of Dr. Lao. That ended up getting cut out because it seemed like too much of a segue away from kind of the direction the story was going. But no, I think for the most part, we at least included, you know, something of all the titles. I know that Tales That Witness Madness, for example, was a early 70s example that wasn't an Amicus film that really only gets mentioned in the opening montage of favorite movies because that whole period is basically covered with Amicus and it would have meant going back. You know? So it was a structural thing that made us take out Tales That Witness Madness, unfortunately.
Yeah. But I think, like, I mean, first of all, kudos to the editor, Mike Capone. So he's the editor that you're mentioning, who did an amazing job on the film. But I think that, yeah, like David says, we're also fans, right? We're also like consumers of these kinds of films. And so I always think of stuff, the stuff has to impress me as a viewer. And I'm a very demanding viewer, you know? And so, you know, and horror fans in general are just rabid fans, you know, they know so much about the genre. And so, of course, you're always worried about leaving stuff out. You want to make sure everything gets honored as it should. And, you know, you also want the people watching it to feel like their favorites got touched on, you know. So definitely trying to be comprehensive is something that David and I think, are always driven to do. Any other questions?
Yeah. We have a couple of questions from the chat, and they're both kind of very similar, so I'll read them both. What are some of your favorite food horror segments in an anthology film? And what are some of your favorite / most inspirational horror or horror-themed documentaries? So why don't we do the food horror?
Okay, the first question is food horror in anthology films?
Food horror segments in an anthology film.
Wow.
where the whole segment is about food?
I mean, yeah. I can think of one, but I made it, so I can't choose.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I think my mic was muted, but I'll say, what are some of your favorite food horror segments in an anthology film?
Uh-huh.
No, I heard the question. I'm just, like, trying to think of what the answer would be.
Yeah.
Because obviously there's some things that came up that where there's, like, scenes that involve food, like yeah. The one at the birthday party with all the kids and the blood spraying all over the birthday party.
Yeah, that's Hammer House of Horror, yeah. And well, yeah, I guess the Hammer House of Horror, the 13th reunion, is, well, it's more fat-related than food-related, but that's a good one, too. I can't think of too many others, though. I like that image from The Vault of Horror, which I never actually saw in the movie, but I would always see it in horror magazines or horror books, of where the vampires are basically in a bar-type situation, where they've got a... the pump that you use to pump beer. What's that called? Well, they've got it in somebody's neck and they're basically drinking out of that. So I've never actually seen it, though. It was always blobbed out whenever it screened on telly in the UK.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if this person has one that they're thinking of.
Yeah, I don't know, Suzanne or Sarah, is there a specific film that you love? Let us know in the chat. But why don't we move on to the next question. What are some of your favorite/most inspirational horror or horror-themed documentaries?
I mean, inspirationally, I would say that things like Dario Argento's World of Horror, Document of the Dead, Tom Savini's Scream Greats, they were the ones that made me want to do horror documentaries, because there weren't enough of them. Like that was stuff that I could have watched for days and days and days, of like, you know, on the set of Dawn of the Dead, or how Tom Savini, you know, chops people's heads off, or what Dario Argento thinks when he's filming a murder scene, stuff like that. And that was definitely something that I thought there was a huge absence of in making ofs, because making ofs at the time were mainly about, you know, Star Wars or Superman or these huge movies. And I really wanted to know more about, you know, how horror movies were made. And there were documentaries about horror movies and vampires and stuff like that, but it wasn't necessarily about the making of movies. So I think when I started doing it in the late 90s, I guess in 2000 was when I did Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Shocking Truth, it seemed like a lot of the people from Texas Chainsaw Massacre hadn't talked about this story on camera very much yet, you know, and so they were very fresh in talking about it. And the stories that went into the making of that movie are insane. And it was a real roller coaster ride that turned out to be a feature, my first feature documentary. Very rough around the edges, very very amateurish, but it was the stories that basically inspired it. And then I did tons of others. So those early examples were the ones that I wanted to see more of.
Yeah, I think like Dario Argento's World of Horror, definitely for me, I watched it so many times as a teenager. I watched it over and over again. I watched Terror in the Isles like a million times.
Yeah.
And then once we got into like the 90s, there was a series that Andy Stark and Pete Toombs did for UK television called Erotica.
Yeah.
Which was like the first series I saw where they did like half an hour episodes on like Jean Rollin and like Jess Franco and like all these European horror directors that, you know, that were sort of in to American audiences anyway, were just starting to get some attention in the fringes, you know, of the scene. And so, so those documentaries I thought were hugely enlightening.
Before that was The Incredibly Strange Film Show as well, which was a massive deal for anyone who was a fan of this kind of movie in England back in the late 80s, because they were talking to people who now seem like kind of giants in this field, like Herschel Gordon Lewis and Russ Meyer and John Waters and people like that. But at the time, to actually get an entire show about their careers was just a big deal. And I think, again, they were talking to, you know, a British TV crew in a way that maybe they hadn't done before. They weren't promoting a new film or anything like that. They were talking about their entire careers, and the various people they'd worked with were interviewed as well. And it was a very handsomely produced show as well. So I think that was a real groundbreaking show that I was addicted to. And they only did two series of it, and then they did a follow-up one, which was a little more highbrow, with David Lynch and Almodovar and Jodorowsky and Aki Kaurismäki with the four that they did in the later series. But still, they were still great episodes, obviously great artists that they used the same format to interview them.
Yeah. Cool. What are your some of your favorite anthologies and segments, and are there any anthologies that have impacted your own careers?
I would say, my favorite anthologies and segments, I've mentioned this before, but the my favorites are probably The Monster Club and Black Sabbath, the Mario Bava movie. Mm-hmm. Favorite segments would be the Shag Mock in The Monster Club, Drop of Water in Black Sabbath, The Lady of the Snows in Quaidan. I also really like the opening segment. I don't remember what the title of it is. The one with Kugulager from The Offspring, the 80s.
I think it's The Offspring, isn't it?
Is it just called The Offspring, that segment? Maybe. I don't remember what the titles are.
Yeah.
Segments. But in terms of like actually impacting my career, the one that I can think that actually has impacted my career is Fears of the Dark, which is the 2007 animated one. And how it impacted my career basically is that it was really only after seeing that movie that I ever considered making a movie, like as a producer, you know, like just because I thought that the concept was so strong in that movie and the aesthetic was so strong, and the way that whoever was obviously the person who had initiated the project and brought these artists together, that they had a vision for this film and how it was all going to fit together aesthetically. And the thing with like animation and to a certain extent with documentaries, you can be kind of modular in how you make the films. It's not like making a narrative feature where all the actors have to be there and you have to do it all at the same time because they might cut their hair or put on weight or whatever, like continuity things, you know? So it's like animation or whatever. You can literally just do it in pieces as you have money, you know? And so when I saw that movie was the first time that it ever became appealing to me, like, oh, maybe I do have skills that are useful that I could transfer into the idea of making a movie, you know? So I haven't made anything yet that looks like that movie, But yeah, I would say that was a big inspiration on me.
Cool.
And my favorites would be the second story from Beyond the Grave, which funnily enough, I didn't get to watch when I first started watching From Beyond the Grave as a child. It's the one with Angela Pleasance, Donald Pleasance, Ian Bannon, and Diana Dawes. The Hume Goo episode of The Monster Club as well, and Dario Argento's Black Cat from Two Evil Eyes. They're probably my favorite episodes, but the overall film I think is still the Uncanny as an entire piece. I also love Hammer House of Horror. That was something that I was quite young when it aired on UK TV. So most of the episodes really burned into my brain as key works from my development as a horror fan. In terms of ones that have impacted my career, it's obviously Theatre Bizarre because that's the one that we made. But it also then led to Lost Soul, the documentary that I did about Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. It led to us doing a lot of the director's projects on Blu-ray, like Combat Shock and No Way Home and Family Portraits and Attica Expeditions, and I've stayed very good friends with the majority of the directors from that, and it opened a lot of doors for us. So there's no doubt that was the one that was a stepping stone to another part of the career.
I wanted to ask you, this is a bit of a funny question, like one thing that I really loved about the documentary is that it wasn't shot, you know, like in a more traditional professional format that you have somebody sitting in a chair with the background that you're just like dialing into these people's and we get to see everybody's house, you know, and my favorite was just like seeing like Ernest Dickerson's like overflowing like movie collection in the background. And like whatever is going on with Reese Shearsmith's like weird blank room and that giant doll in the corner.
Yeah, it's from Magic. He's got a replica of Fats from Magic, which when it first shows up on screen, it's actually quite jarring, which is perfect.
Yeah, but I guess my question was like was that exciting for you to peek into everybody's home life and see like how they live and where they live and like what they collect, because I mean like it really says a lot about a person, like especially like, you know, like there's been a lot of talk about Zoom etiquette and like, you know, putting yourself in a spot with a nice background, like I think, you know, like Olivia and Kayla, you're doing really well. They're like sitting in this room full of mess.
Yeah. No, it's true, and I think that was something that was kind of a bit of a gift to us as filmmakers, because that actually, you know, one thing we were worried about is just how crude it looks when you're recording Zoom. Some of them are not, the internet's not working properly, and they're very jerky, you know. But I think the upside of that is exactly what you're talking about. It's something that immediately, right now, we know what we're looking at. We know we're looking at somebody talking through Zoom. So we got over that quite quickly. But the bonus of that is that you do get to see people's environments, you know, and they're not actually set up in this interview setup that has been staged around them. You know, it's their area. So
I mean, that was exciting to me, even when COVID started and we started having work meetings. Just seeing my coworkers where they lived.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we got over that quite quickly. It was actually something that I don't know how it will age because of that, but and I certainly don't necessarily want all of our documentaries to take that form. But in the case of this and the way that the project evolved, it actually worked very much in our favor.
Yeah, it was very cute. Yeah, it's also funny when people choose to have like a background, like a fake background. Mm-hmm. And so like, cause there's definitely some people I've interviewed where it's just, that's how they like to do Zoom. They like to have a fake background, but then every time they move their head, like part of their head gets cut off and stuff.
Yeah. And so one of our interviewers has Dr. Terrace House of Horrors train cabin behind them. And then another one has the Slapshot poster behind them. So couldn't be asked to change it.
And I think like Marcel Perks just has like, I don't know, Peter Curtin or some like a serial killer behind her, like all big.
Yeah, so I just
but
have
they get to set up their environment. That's the point, or not set it up, but it's their environment that we're looking at.
Yeah, so I just have one last question. Do either of you have any advice for anyone watching who may be interested in a career in filmmaking?
Well, David Witt has way more experience in filmmaking than me, so he should answer this.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that you really need to just start doing something, start creating something, because nobody's going to actually give you the opportunity, no matter how great the script is that you've written or how great the project is that you want to pitch, because there's no end of those. You know, usually you have to have proven that you can actually do it before anyone will let you do it. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, it's actually so much easier to actually go out and make your own film than it was, you know, even 15, 20 years ago, because the technology is such that anybody can do it. So really, creativity is now the key thing. The problem is, we actually get somebody to sit down and watch what it is that you've done, but that's a lot easier than getting somebody to sit down and read a script that you've written. So you know, and certainly to get your project out there and seen is a lot easier now as well, because you can actually be in control of it. To monetize it's a whole different matter, but to actually get it out there and say, okay, this is where my film is that I made to be seen, is so much easier now. So really it's up to you if you want to do it. There are, that you've just got to be creative and go out and do it.
Okay, well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time because I just looked at the clock, but we have a question from Dave Barber in the chat, and he has a question for David that's a little bit off topic about Lost Soul, and he just wants to know, how did you get all those crew people to speak so honestly?
Because they trusted me. No, it was actually because this was a particular story that again, there was a certain amount of good fortune involved with it, because people hadn't really been asked to speak on in any kind of official capacity about it before. And it's probably a story that they've been telling friends and people at gatherings over the years. Have I got a crazy story for you? You know, and so to actually sit down and talk, they were probably telling stories that they'd told before, but you know, these were just, it was such an insane production that they were willing to talk about it. I mean, I don't think there was too many crew people who wanted to throw anybody else under the bus necessarily. So, you know, particularly people who were still working in the business. But the fact was, I mean, it was a matter of record how, you know, certain things went down in the making of that movie. And everybody just had their own perspective of seeing it happening. And it was usually in disbelief. So it was like, I'm telling you this story in thinking that you probably wouldn't believe it. And certainly when I started the project and I just had Richard talking about it, it seemed, it immediately, two things became clear. One, this needs to be a feature documentary, because that's not how it started. And two, I need to get as many of the other people who are involved in this story to tell their version of events, because nobody's going to believe it if it's just Richard telling it. And sure enough, you know, the majority of people who we approached agreed to do it. There were a few exceptions, like Val Kilmer, but for the most part, people were like, "Oh yeah, that is a unique experience in my professional career." So they were happy to talk about it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for doing this, and thank you so much for allowing us to show the film in CineTech at home. And we just extended it until January 8th, so it gives some people some more time to watch it or watch it again over the holidays. And thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. It actually makes great holiday viewing too, because the whole idea of like winter's tales and, you know, people telling in England and Europe and stuff, that tradition is a lot more associated with like Christmas than Halloween. So.
And one of the great Christmas horror stories of all time is from an anthology, which is Joan Collins and Tales from the Crypt. Joan Collins versus Santa Claus.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having us, and thank you for playing the film. And I hope everybody gets a chance to watch it and enjoys it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.